Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the state Senate considers major school funding reforms.
I am very hopeful. I mean, I understand when you're talking billions of dollars. You know, it's not something that's going to happen all at once.
We'll also talk with incoming Senate President Karen Spilka. Also today...
So how can I help you?
Hi, I'm calling to book a woman's haircut for a client. I'm looking for something on May 3rd.
That's not a real person on the phone. It's Google technology, and it sounds a little too real for comfort. And the story of Prudence Crandall and the nation's first academy for African American girls. It stayed open in the 1830s despite attacks, vandalism, and state laws being passed against them.
It was a feat to have it open. 17 minutes would have been something, but to be able to do that for 17 months was just phenomenal.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Beacon Hill has a marvelous habit of giving the driest, wonkiest names to the most important concepts. Today's case in point... the foundation budget formula. I know you're all yawning already, right? Well, in non-policy speak, we're talking about money for schools, state funds for Massachusetts K through 12 to be exact. The foundation budget formula is the tool first created a quarter century ago to determine exactly how much each city and town ought to be spending on their schools and how much money the state will chip in. And as I said, the formula has been the same for about 25 years. But today, on Beacon Hill, in the Senate, the foundation budget formula could come a step closer to a major overhaul, which could drive hundreds of millions more dollars into education funding. For the latest on this, we're joined now by WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin. He's at the State House. Hello, Max.
Hi, Meghna.
So, it sounds like, are you in a hallway in the State House right now?
I am in a hallway. I am definitely in a hallway, yes.
You have stepped away from some action that's going on in the Senate. So, what's happening on Beacon Hill right now?
Yes, everything's running a little late, but in effect, what's happening is a chorus of senators are coming forward and saying, it's about time we fix the foundation budget. This is that important formula that sets the minimum, and while I stepped into the hallway, it was Republican Senate Minority Leader Bruce Tarr who was saying it's about time for this reckoning. So no one said a bad word about the bill or the idea of spending more or raising the estimate of the cost of education. It seems like a pretty unanimous body.
Okay, interesting. So the key thing here, though, is that this upgrade or update or modernization of the foundation budget formula would essentially end up saying that there's a shortage of funding for schools in Massachusetts. I mean, how much of a shortage are we talking about?
It could be quite substantial. By one estimate of the Mass Budget and Policy Center, they had it at about $2 billion, and that was now a number of years ago. What's really driving it, we believe, is that the rising cost of health care. As most Americans, many business owners know, that's really dramatically outpaced the growth of many, many other commodities, and certainly outpaced inflation, which is what they had pegged it to back in 1993. So many districts are spending twice as much or more on health insurance as they expected to back in 1993, and that means they've had to cut in other places.
I see. So just to reiterate what you're saying, the foundation budget formula, it pegs this baseline cost for what the state would believe is a quality education in Massachusetts cities and towns. And if this change does become official, still has to go through the House, but if it becomes official, that baseline is going to could be raised by as much as $2 billion. All right. So what would that change then mean for school districts?
Well, if you think about a rich district like, say, Newton or Weston, they're already spending out of their own coffers well above what the state requires them to spend, partly because they want to have good schools. They've got a lot of property taxes. They're not getting a ton of state aid. It's just a community priority. So this bill wouldn't amount to a huge change for them. It would mean a little more state aid. But for communities that are just barely being able to pay this minimum amount, even with a lot of state aid, namely the poorer gateway communities, Lynn, Lawrence, it could really make a big difference there. It would mean the state is taking on a lot more responsibility in terms of dollars and cents for what's going on in those districts. And, you know, right now the gallery in the temporary Senate chamber is full of people from Brockton, Brockton being the community at the center of so much ed reform agitation in this state for many years now. And I spoke to one teacher who was sitting there, Joanna Schnitz. She's been teaching in the district, an English teacher at the high school, for 6 years. She's been laid off in five of those years, only to be rehired. She told me that that was a function of just not having enough money to provide even really committed teachers with job security.
They don't have the money to do it, to pay for me and for my colleagues. And they lose a lot of good teachers that way. So it does taint the experience a bit when you want to feel like you're part of the community and really give it your all. But you know that if you, the longer you invest, as you're investing all your energy, the reward for it is a layoff at the end.
Mm. So we are talking about the potential for significant new state funding, as we were saying, Max, to cities and towns that need it most for their schools. But where would the money come from?
I think that's a little bit of an open question. This bill isn't entirely passed yet. It's just, it represents, and the language of duty was something that those various senators were using on both sides of the aisle. This is something we have to do. So it means it'll make, you know, there'll probably be some hard budgetary choices. I think one thing that the lead sponsor, Sonia Chang-Diaz, is admittedly looking forward to a little bit is that millionaire's tax that may be passed by Massachusetts voters on the ballot in November. That could generate a kind of windfall that would make a lot of these decisions a lot easier. I spoke with Kathleen Smith. She's the superintendent down in Brockton, and she says she does hear from some people who are concerned about this funding issue. We could hear a little bit of tape from that, please.
I think there's concerns about funding, and believe me, when you look at that commission and the recommendations really covered a wide range of funding. You're talking everything from special, all budget busters, special education, health insurance, inflation rates, transportation, you know, regional schools, you know, stresses on a budget for rural schools.
So, Max, go ahead.
I think Superintendent Smith's point there is these are things that we are absolutely committed to seeing districts do. So it is something that we see, you know, back to our 1780 Constitution, Vegna, as something absolutely essential to the character of Massachusetts. So we have to make those choices, in other words.
But as you were saying a little earlier, Max, thus far in the Senate debate over changes to the foundation budget formula, you haven't heard any dissenters.
There's actually nothing. I think 36 out of 38 sitting senators have co-sponsored this bill, so it's nearly unanimous that this has to get done.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens in the Senate and then later on in the House, of course. That's WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin speaking to us from Beacon Hill about the foundation budget formula, also, you know, a.k.a. major school funding reform. Conversation about that going on in the Senate. Thank you so much, Max.
Thanks, Magna.
All right, well, let's turn now to Senator Karen Spilka. She is a senator from Ashland. She's also chair of the Ways and Means Committee in the Senate, and she is going to be, soon to be, the new president of the Massachusetts State Senate. She stepped away from this conversation in the Senate chamber to talk with us. Senator Spilka, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon. Thanks for inviting me.
I'm really glad to have you, and I appreciate, again, that you're stepping away from debate in the Senate about the foundation budget formula to talk with us. So appreciate your time. I mean, first of all, tell me about your view of these proposed changes to the foundation budget formula. I mean, you've been calling for a long time for some ed funding reform in Massachusetts.
Right. And you just hit the nail on the head. My springboard back in 2001, 2002 was I ran for the legislature to change the education funding formula at the time. I'd run for school committee, was on it in the late 1998-99, formed a statewide coalition using my background in conflict resolution to form a statewide coalition that we called the Chapter 70 Roundtable to come up with principles. And we came up with the principles of change for increasing adequacy, equity, predictability, and making the formula simpler. And we filled that in with substance, and then we started meeting with legislators to change the funding formula. In late 2001, my state rep resigned, and I thought, wow, I could make better changes from within the state house than from outside. And that was what was my why I made the decision originally to run for the legislature.
And so do you think
so
this,
it's a real pleasure.
Yeah, I was just going to say, do you think this new bill adequately covers the concerns that people have had with the foundation budget formula?
I think it is a huge step. I think, the 1993 ed funding created, the formula was created. It was what was seen as landmark at the time. We made some changes in 06 and 07. It addressed the last three of the four principles that I just mentioned, the equity, predictability, and it did make it simpler, although it's still really complex. But the adequacy piece, the piece that our Constitution says that each child must have an adequate education, eluded us. And over this last quarter of a decade, since 93, so much has changed in education. We did not fund really much of health care, if at all. And health care, just like on the state budget, is eating up more and more of a district's budget. We did not look into, what should have been the true costs of special education and English language learner and low-income students and other areas. So the Foundation Budget Review Commission's recommendations gives us a much better idea of what does it cost to adequately educate our child. And
Senator,
we clearly want to have equality.
Senator Spilkin, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I wanted jump in quickly and ask you, discussion around these two major factors, healthcare and special ed, and how the foundation budget formula is lagging behind reality has been going on for years now, right? There was the Foundation Budget Formula Review Committee report from several years ago. It basically came up with the same conclusions, but it didn't go anywhere. What's different now that's allowed the bill to advance as far as a full Senate debate that's different from, several years ago when people first started talking vigorously about this?
Just like, in 99, when I started forming the Roundtable Coalition, it took several years to build up critical mass to make the 06, 07 changes. And then the same thing happens with this. The formula is so complex and it hits each different and, each district differently. So if you change one little thing, it impacts one district very differently than another. And it takes a while for all of the districts, I think, to better understand what these changes mean and how it would impact them. So there is the priority. I think the whole legislature and the Senate, I can speak on behalf of the Senate, we have passed this bill. We've included it when we did the RISE Act for charter reform as well. Mm-hmm. We've included it in the budgets. It is time. The districts are hurting, and we need to start implementing, which we do in the budget that we just, unveiled today.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the key question, though. You're right to have mentioned that the changes were previously proposed in budgets of several years past, but they kept getting removed. They were cut out. So I guess what I'm saying is, how do you anticipate running into the brick wall that is Robert DeLeo and House leadership when it comes to finding the several billion dollars we might be talking about here in changes that would come with the foundation budget formula?
Well, I know the members of the House have a desire to do this as well. Everybody, the reps, senators, we're all hearing from our school districts, our constituents. We all know kids and have cities and towns that are hurting because of the formula at this point in time. I know Alice Peisch, the state rep, who's chair of the Education Committee, as well as Sonia Chang Diaz, the senator, have worked really, really hard on this bill. So a lot of it is, how do we fund this? The House also begins to implement it. The governor did, the beginning of health insurance costs. The House did health insurance costs. That is one of the four major recommendations of the Foundation Budget Review Commission. So there is the intent, even, through the governor, through the House, to begin to implement this. The Senate takes some extra funds and starts implementing the English language learner piece. So we add another piece to this to continue to fund this. And we will continue to work on it. And I believe the House will also. We need to come up with a consistent stream of revenue to truly implement this in a full phase-in that is consistent and systematic.
And so what would be the parts of that revenue stream? Where would that stream begin?
Well, right now it's beginning just through the budget, just like the Senate has prioritized to take, you know, but it's all choices. Each line item in the budget are priorities of the Senate and our values. We are clearly putting a value on education. Yeah. It's our future. It's, you know, our kids are our future, and we need to invest in our future. So we take some extra funding and put it towards implementing the Foundation Budget Review Commission's recommendations. We put some to increasing the special ed circuit breaker and funding that at the full level, and a little more for charter school reimbursement as well, with recognition that we need to continue to invest. But we can't do it at the level that we actually need. And that's where the Fair Share Amendment, or what's sometimes called the Millionaire's Tax, would provide $1 billion every year just for education funding. Yeah.
So it seems, I mean, there's other issues in the Senate that I want to talk to you about, but it seems as if there's a lot of consensus around the need for reform around this funding formula, but many unanswered questions that you're going to have to get to over time in terms of where the new revenues are going to come from. So we'll keep our eyes on that. But I do want to ask you, you're going to take over the presidency of the Senate at the end of July. The Senate as a body on Beacon Hill right now is a wounded institution because of the fallout from what has happened with former Senator Stan Rosenberg and his now estranged spouse, Brian Hefner, and the sexual harassment allegations that have been really roiling the Senate for many months now. I'm curious. What impact do you think, from your view, has all of this had on the Senate as a body?
I do want to start out by saying that we have continued to do the people's work, and we have met every single week other than the two vacation weeks, and we have done bills. We have been as productive as prior years, if not more so. You know, Ways and Means, the other members have been working really hard to do that. I do believe, though, as well, that the Senate has some healing to do after these last few months. I am acutely aware of it, and I believe that we need to ensure that every single member, every staff member, every member of the public, for whatever reason they come into the Senate, knows that this body, this state house, is a warm, welcoming, safe place to be. And we will work with Senator Joan Lovely. Next week we'll be unveiling the Sexual Harassment Committee's work with some recommendations on what changes maybe to our policy or what more we can do. There are things we need to change the culture. It's as simply as that. Any behavior that even hints of unwelcoming or disrespectful behavior is just not welcome here, not wanted in the state house, will not be accepted. So I look forward to working with my colleagues in the Senate and members and listening to hear what more we can do, how we can help to change the culture, how we can maybe work with the House and the administration and really make the state house a warm and welcoming, safe and respectful environment.
Well, just to remind folks the reason why this is such a important top of mind issue for the Massachusetts State Senate. I just want to play some tape here from last week. This is Committee Chair Michael Rodriguez saying that this is the Ethics Committee Chair saying that former Senator Rosenberg did in not acting on what he knew his husband was doing, that he did tarnish the Senate as an institution.
Senator Rosenberg undermined the goal of the Senate's anti-harassment policy to promote a workplace free from sexual and other forms of discriminatory harassment because he knew or should have known that Hefner had racially and sexually harassed Senate employees and failed to address the issue adequately.
Senator Spilka, I wanted to play that because there's also this issue of rules that were in place that weren't followed. So what assurance can you give Senate staffers, Beacon Hill lobbyists, who the people who come in and out of that building every day, that any new rules would be any more effective?
We will look at our rules when we review them in January again, when we have to adopt the Senate rules. Nothing is off the table at this point. We will look at every possibility, as I said, that has the goal of making the Senate a warm, welcoming, and respectful place to work, to visit, to do business, for whatever reason people come, for interns, for anybody, I think it's really important. So we will take another look at our rules, our policies, look at what else we can do to be more open and transparent in what we are doing as well. Hmm. You know, I think that I need some time to meet with people and hear and listen to what they think might be a good thing to bring to the Senate.
Is this going to be a priority of yours when you become Senate president?
It's definitely one of my top priorities.
Okay. And then
definitely.
And then what can you, we've just got a minute here. What are going to be some of your other top priorities?
Well, you know, I do believe that I want to implement a collaborative form. My background as a social worker, as a labor and employment attorney, arbitrator, mediator is very collaborative. I want to have institute a more collaborative Senate where people are working together, have mentoring from veteran senators to new senators, and to make some changes with that as well, and to implement some of the areas of education. I think, you know, again, the Foundation Budget Review Commission, we need to keep looking at that bill, looking at how we implement transportation so that every area of the state has the transportation and infrastructure they need, continue with opioid and substance abuse, but blend more mental health issues into that as well. So there's lots of areas and lots of issues. And I'm looking forward to meeting with all of my colleagues and hearing their priorities.
Well, Senator Karen Spilka is expected to take over the Senate presidency in July. Senator Spilka, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A former New Hampshire Supreme Court Chief Justice is visiting schools around New England to talk about the darkest time in his life. Usually, he ends up hearing from students about some of their dark times, too. WBUR's Deborah Becker reports on this effort to inspire the next generation to change the culture around mental illness.
During a recent visit to Salem, New Hampshire High School, hundreds of students intently listened as former Chief Justice John Broderick talked about his oldest son.
He was a really talented artist, and so he spent a lot of time in his room with the door closed at his desk drawing. Today, I would describe it as withdrawing.
That withdrawing, Broderick says, was the first sign something was wrong. But his family didn't know much about mental health, so they let it go. In college, Broderick's son began drinking heavily. When his son moved back home to go to graduate school, he was drinking daily, and addiction specialists urged Broderick and his wife to kick their son out.
It was the hardest decision we ever made and the worst decision. But it was well-intended, but it was absolutely the wrong choice.
After a few weeks, Broderick let his son move back home, but he believes the time spent on the streets exacerbated his son's illness, and eventually his son erupted. Although Broderick doesn't recall the details, his son attacked him in his sleep.
And so one night, he assaulted me. I went to the intensive care unit at the Elliott Hospital. I was there 6 or 8 days. I have no memory of that. My handsome, funny, talented, master's-educated son was arraigned in a public courtroom, issued an orange jumpsuit, and went to the Valley Street Jail.
His son ended up serving 3 years in prison, and Broderick lived in fear, questioning whether to leave his job to keep his son safe.
20 to 25% of my day job was hearing appeals from the very population with whom my son would now be living. I wasn't really popular at the state prison. That'll keep you up at night, by the way.
But jail marked the first time that his son's mental illness was diagnosed and treated.
And he said to me, "Dad, I feel so different." He said, "I haven't felt like this, Dad, since I was a kid. I can sleep through the night. I'm focused, Dad. My mind's not racing anymore." And when he told us that night, I knew that we had failed him. I was the parent. I should have known something about mental illness.
To help others know something about mental illness, Broderick has addressed more than 200 groups over the past 2 years as part of a campaign called Change Direction. He wants people to be as familiar with the signs of mental illness as they are with the signs of physical illnesses, such as heart attacks or strokes. The students in Salem who wait to talk with Broderick appear to know something about mental health. They share stories about themselves, their families. One young man talks about a friend's suicide.
A friend of ours, he passed away a year ago Saturday, took his own life, and the whole time I was listening to your story.
Oh, my God.
I couldn't stop thinking about him, so.
Well, you want to know something? That young man didn't ask for that problem. And, you know, if you, as my generation, missed the boat, if your generation says, hey, enough of this nonsense, we'll start talking about it.
Another student weeps and embraces Broderick.
What grade are you in?
I'm a sophomore.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to thank you because your message is so important. And I think it's really important for people to, like, understand that people are, like, suffering. Like, it's not okay.
Are you suffering? Are you seeing someone? Get any help? Good for you, by the way. And you should feel zero shame. Seriously. Okay, so stick with the program.
Broderick believes this upcoming generation is the least judgmental in history, and he hopes he's making a difference by inspiring change.
It's the single most important thing I've ever done. It's acutely personal, and people share their stories with me that they would never share with me because I had been a judge, or they don't care. What they care about is this guy will understand, and he's advocating for people like me. And so before we strap a gun on the math teacher, you know, I think we need to do a lot. If I could speak every single day to a different high school, I would do it.
Broderick has spoken at more than 75 New Hampshire schools, and he's talking with officials in other New England states as well. His son is doing well. Broderick says he hasn't touched alcohol since before he went to prison, and his son is now married with a 9-year-old daughter.
That report from WBUR's Deborah Becker. Google will be rolling out an ambitious new update for Android. The goal? Google says it wants you to spend less time on your smartphone. Ain't gonna happen, says Hiawatha Bray, tech writer at the Boston Globe, and he joins us now. Hello, Hiawatha.
Hello there. And not only is it not going to happen, they know it's not going to happen.
So what's the point?
Well, no, actually, let's be fair. I think what they're doing is very sensible. They are trying to build tools for those of us who do want to cut back. And they're also trying to position themselves as being socially responsible about a real problem. I mean, my wife is the one who's always telling me, put down the phone, put down the phone. And she has a point. And it's good to have ways of actually making that easier. Meanwhile, they are approaching this at a moment when major tech companies like Google and Facebook are kind of under a shadow right now. And their public reputation is taking a beating.
Right.
This gives them a chance to seem like they're being socially responsible.
It's such a
and
good,
I think they are.
Well, it's such a good thing that this is radio because no one can see my hard eye roll going on right now. Okay, so before I let
I don't find that.
Well, before I let my cynicism take over this conversation, tell me in a little bit more detail what are these tools that they're going to be offering and how might they work.
Well, no. Well, the idea is that they're going to give you easy ways to keep track of how long you're spending on various apps throughout the day. You're going to have a timer that basically says, well, you spent 2 hours today looking at Facebook. You spent 2 hours today checking your email, and so on. And app developers will actually be able to tailor their apps so that they would be able to program them so that after a certain amount of time, you might actually get a warning saying it's time for you to dial back on this. They haven't described it in great detail, but if you look at the screenshots they've posted, one thing they show is an option that says pause app. And that suggests that you'll be able to develop, you'll see future apps developed where if you use the app more than you really want to on a particular day, it could say, all right, that's it for today, no more. And it could very well work that way.
Is your smartphone in the studio with you right now?
Yeah, it's in my pocket.
Okay, I'm just checking.
I'm not using it at this moment.
Just checking.
But yeah, there's another really cool thing, this whole do not disturb thing, where you don't only just turn off the ringer, you turn off ringer, you turn off vibrate, and you turn off the screen all at once. And not only that, they've set it up for what they call, I love this name, shush mode. And that is where you would take your phone and turn it face down on a table. The minute you do that, the phone goes into shush mode. It will not ring, it will not buzz, nothing will happen at all. You want to get anything, you turn it face up. Bang, you're back on the air. I think that's a very clever idea.
Okay, so these could be very useful tools, as you said, for people who want them. But to let my cynicism creep back in here, I mean, Google makes, what, billions upon billions of dollars from in ad revenue through mobile phones.
$110 billion.
So they're not genuinely interested in reducing people's time on their phones.
I don't think they expect it to happen, and I think they're right. I think their attitude is, look, most people are going to keep right on using their phones as much as ever, but we're going to make it easier for the people who want to cut back. I don't think that's unusual. You see this kind of thing in other industries all the time. It's like the alcohol industry and know when to say when and all that, and please drink responsibly. They know that they have a social there's a social benefit to them and a benefit to their business if they are perceived as not wanting us all to be drunks. And I think that's, I don't see that as contradictory to their desire to make lots and lots of money.
Okay, I'm not yet sold, but I see your point.
It just seems reasonable to me. I don't think this is phony, but at the same time, I think they're perfectly convinced that very few people are going to use it.
Right. Okay, well, so let's move on and talk about another piece of Google technology, which maybe, every time I talk to you, Hiawatha, I think for anyone who's a regular listener to the show, they're going to think I'm an absolute Luddite because I'm always like, oh my God, this is freaking me out. But this one genuinely does. So let me just play a clip here. This is from a new AI technology called Google Duplex, and Google introduced it at a conference on Tuesday in California. And Google Duplex here calling a hair salon.
So how can I help you? Hi, I'm calling to book a women's haircut for a client. I'm looking for something on May 3rd.
Sure, give me 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, what time are you looking for around?
At 12 p.m.
So the person making the call was actually Google Duplex, which is this new AI technology. And it seems as if the salon employee on the other end did not know that she was talking to a computer.
And that's the problem. I think it's a manageable problem, but it is a problem. They did this demo, and the CEO of Google said, and this is exactly the way it sounded, in which case they got problems because there should have been something up front saying, you are talking to a computer, and it is recording everything you say. Now, would you make an appointment for me? That is a real issue. This is a really interesting idea where you'd be able to sit in front of your calendar, and you use your phone, and you tell it, I want to make an appointment for such and such, and instead of you having to go online and find out if they can make an appointment for you, it places a phone call to the company, and this voice asks, can you have an appointment at such and such a time? It's amazing. It's almost ghostly and spooky.
Well, I mean, the from the clip we heard, the AI voice even does uh-huh and and ums,
yep,
as well.
Yep. That's right. It's very deliberately designed to sound as human as possible. And that's one of the things that makes it a little creepy. But also the fact that, at least during the demo, nobody is given any indication that they're talking to a computer. And you have to remember, when you do anything with Google, and I mean anything, they record it. Every time you use Google, whatever you're doing to them is being recorded. And that's one thing if you're yourself going out to do this. But what if Google is reaching out to you and saying, hello, I'm talking to you, and oh, by the way, I'm not telling you the fact that I'm recording every word you say in reply.
Yeah.
That's going to be an issue. They're going to have to tell people about that.
Well, and then this technology that they, even from that little clip, it seemed like the AI is very, very responsive. But did Google say that there are certain things that it can't do yet when conversations get more complicated?
Yeah. About 99.9% of everything it can't do yet. It's been very carefully tailored. Oh, yeah. It's been very carefully tailored to do a very small number of things. It can make appointments for, it can buy dinner reservations. It can make appointments at hair salons. And it can look for the business hours of a store. It can say, well, how late are you open? Things like that. That's because they have very tightly focused on those skills. It's like the skills you hear about with Alexa, you know, Amazon Alexa, where they have skills where it's trained to do some specific thing. That's what they're going to do with this. And little by little,
for
in theory,
now,
they're going to train it. Exactly. They're going to train it to do more and more and more and more. And ultimately, the idea is they want to develop machines that will be able to talk to you just like you'd be talking to a person.
That actually does worry me. And especially, like you said, if they don't disclose, or guess what? What happens when they make it sound like I'm talking to Hiawatha Bray, but I may not be. Or I'm talking to President Donald Trump. I mean, how are we? We got 10 seconds here, Hiawatha. I mean, like, how?
There you go. It's like those X-rated videos they're making where they actually take a real person, and the video is now so good that it makes it look exactly like the real person. They may be able to do that with your voice someday, but I think that's a ways off.
Hiawatha Bray, technology writer for the Boston Globe. I've said this like multiple times with you, but today I absolutely assure you it is me and not yet a bot. So thank you so much for joining me.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Okay.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In Canterbury, Connecticut, tucked away in the eastern side of the state and behind a white post and rail fence, there's a beautiful old house with a truly remarkable history. It's the Prudence Crandall Museum, and it's home to what was the nation's first private academy for young African-American women. Kaz Kozlowski has been the curator at the Prudence Crandall Museum for the past 35 years, and she retired earlier this year. Soon after she announced her retirement, I sat down with Kaz and asked her to tell us Prudence Crandall's story about how in 1832, Crandall, as a white Quaker-raised woman, decided to turn her school, once meant to educate the fine white female citizenry, into a school that championed young black girls from the Northeast's free black community. As Kaz Kozlowski is quick to say, the story doesn't really begin with Prudence Crandall. It begins with a young African-American woman with a thirst for knowledge, Sarah Harris.
If there was not a Sarah Harris, there would be no Prudence Crandall and there would be no Prudence Crandall Museum. She's the linchpin in the entire story because in the fall of 1832, Sarah Harris is looking to get a further education for herself, comes to Crandall that fall and requests, as we have in her own words, to get a little more learning.
You know, you must have wished this so many times over your more than 30 years at the museum to have been a fly on the wall in the room.
In many, many instances to be able to really hear the conversation that would have gone between those two women. You had Crandall, who was an extremely, she was educated, she was strong, came from a family that was very steely in their nature. And then to have Sarah Harris, who, again, to the credit of her family, her parents, they raised a young woman that had the fortitude and the self-respect and also, you know, the courage herself to make that request. But to hear that conversation between the two of them, I mean, in fact, we do know that when Sarah made the request of Crandall, she basically added a disclaimer. She said to Crandall, I would like to get a little more learning, if at least to educate other young black students. But if my request will bring you any harm, I will withdraw it. So she realizes what that request is asking and it gives her that. If Crandall felt that she wasn't able to answer yes, then she's giving her a way to be able to say no. But we do know that Crandall never saw no as the answer to give.
Because here's the thing, right? I mean, those two women together were basically imagining something that didn't really exist at all at the time, right? An integrated school. They were imagining a world that didn't yet exist.
Right. And Meghna, do keep in mind that schools, most of them here in Connecticut would have been integrated. A one-room schoolhouse, those public schools would have had white and black children being educated in the same classroom. What Crandall and Sarah are envisioning is a higher level of education that was never seen before. It was the first private academy, the first in the nation to have provided education to young black women.
I see. So Prudence said yes.
She did. And she said yes, but she hesitates for just a bit, only to the effect that she begins looking at if and when the pushback would happen, what she would do in response to that.
And the pushback did happen.
What
happened?
Initially, when word gets out that Crandall has allowed Sarah Harris into the academy as a paid student, many of the white families come to her, begin threatening that if she doesn't withdraw Sarah Harris from the academy, they would begin withdrawing their own children. They assume that with the threat that she would back down, but she doesn't. She looks at that as, well, perhaps if I'm losing the support of the white community, what can I do to increase support? And what would the option be? And she begins to realize, well, if there is one Sarah Harris, if there's one Harris family that can afford the tuition to send their daughter here, perhaps there were other upper middle class African-American families that might have daughters who they would also be interested to send. And again, as fate would have it, Sarah Harris had begun leaving copies of the Liberator newspaper at the academy. And they realized that Crandall had been reading these papers. So with that knowledge, when Crandall realizes that she's losing the support of the white community, She sends a letter up to Boston to William Lloyd Garrison, the publisher of the Liberator paper, sends a letter of introduction and makes arrangements that she would meet with him in January of 1833. And when she arrives there, she already goes there with this seed of an idea that perhaps he would be able to give her letters of introduction to other families who might be interested in sending their daughters to her school.
Just to not to put too fine a point on it, or actually, you know, let me take that back. I will put a finer point on it. I mean, I've read that there were attacks on the school. Is that right?
There were. Over the coming months, the anger, the animosity, the pushback increased from she formally reopened the academy on April 1st, 1833, with advertisements that stated that it was making a shift and becoming an academy solely for the purpose of educating little misses, young ladies and little misses of color. When that announcement is made about a month later in May of 1833, the legislature in Hartford, they pass what was called the Black Law, which makes it illegal for Crandall to operate the academy. But she continues. She continues even after she's arrested. She spends one night in Brooklyn, Connecticut's jail. That would have been the county seat at the time. It escalates from the legal actions to the academy would have been, you know, pelted with filth. The girls were threatened. Over the 17 months that the academy actually functioned and remained open, the anger continued to increase to, in January of 1834, there's an attempt to set the building on fire. And then it's on September 9th, 1834, the final, her determination that she can't keep the academy open anymore is when a mob attacks the building. It was a feat to have it open. 17 minutes would have been something, but to be able to do that for 17 months was just phenomenal.
Yeah. About the Black Law, are you saying that the state of Connecticut went out of its way, essentially, to pass a law putting major obstacles in the path of anyone who wanted to teach African-American students because of Prudence Crandall's school?
That's in a nutshell, yes. They formulated the law in direct response to what she was doing. It did not affect public schools, so it did not impact Black children going to Connecticut's one-room schoolhouses, the district schools, but they made it illegal for anyone to establish a private academy for African-American students in Connecticut without getting the town's prior approval, which she had not done, and even if she had made the request, the response would have been no.
There's so much to talk with you about, Kaz. I don't even know where to go. Do I understand correctly that the person who wrote the Black Law in 1833, 5 years later, fought for its repeal?
Yes. A man by the name of Senator Philip Pearl was a staunch colonizationist, very pro-slavery when he assisted in passing the Black Law in 1833. Some 5 years later, when the law was repealed, by that point, he had had this change of heart and basically said that he would shed tears of blood for his involvement in what he had done those years previous. He was so ashamed of himself, and he became a staunch abolitionist in his later years.
God, wow.
Yeah, he saw the error of his ways and did try to make amends for it.
What happened? What ended up happening to Prudence Crandall?
So the students in their own right went on to become teachers, activists. They were involved in abolition, Underground Railroad. What was instilled in them, what they shared during those 17 months, they took with them. And Crandall, on her part, she also continued to be a teacher. So even after the academy was forced to close in September of 1834, but wherever she found herself, she was providing an education.
I'm seeing here that at least at one point in time, she was in Kansas teaching Native American students.
She was. She taught in both. She lived in Illinois for a period of time and then spent her later years in a small community in southeastern Kansas, Elk Falls, Kansas. We know that she taught in both the district schools and also in her home. And we know she taught adults, children, Native Americans, white, African Americans, truly whoever in that community needed an education, she was there for them.
And it seems as if there are so many people who are connected to this story in ways that I had never heard of before I started looking into this and in anticipation of talking to you. Mark Twain has a connection to Prudence Crandall?
He did. He actually offered to buy the house back the building that had housed her academy in the 1830s. He was willing to buy that for her if she was willing to move back to Connecticut. And obviously, it goes without saying how flattered she was. She knew of him, you know, his reputation. They corresponded. And as flattered as she was by the offer, but her response to him was something that the air was much sweeter in Kansas than it had ever been in Connecticut. But would he be so kind as to send a photograph of himself and copies of some of his books, which she would then share with her neighbors?
Now, Kaz, the last couple of questions I have for you are about, you know, how much progress we have or haven't made since the 1830s. Because someone drove by the school while you were during your time there and yelled a racial epithet. Is that right?
I think the story that you're referring to happened probably 15, 20 years ago, where it was an August evening, probably 1 or 2 in the morning. Again, Canterbury is a quiet community, you know, no sound other than the crickets and dogs barking. And in the midst of all of this, a car came, you know, kind of, you know, zooming down one of the side roads, and someone yelled something out of the car that, you know, all of a sudden you realize what it must have felt like, or not, at least it was close to imagining what it would have felt like for those young women to hear people yelling insults at them and making threats at them. You know, I'm not going to repeat what they said because I wouldn't dignify it, but it really sent chills.
So here we are in 2018. Have we achieved the world that Prudence and Sarah envisioned when Sarah came to her and said, I want to learn, and Prudence said, come to my school? I mean, have we achieved that world?
I think, Magna, as difficult this is a tough one.
Why is it a tough one?
Because I never would have imagined that we would be living through a period of time that hate and racial bias and, splitting communities rather than pulling together would be used as a political means. Again, that's my personal opinion, but I think I don't think Prudence and Sarah could have envisioned the political environment that we're in the middle of right now, but I think they would have assured us that the majority of individuals are better than that. But on the other side of that coin, this past year working at the Crandall Museum has brought in visitors who are looking to talk about issues, who are looking for a place to explore their history. And I think part of that is to be reminded that we're better than that, and that we owe those people who did what they did, you know, so many years ago to fight for a better world, that we owe them to fight that same fight.
Mm. I mean, doesn't the very existence of Prudence Crandall and Sarah Harris and their story, and that's told by the museum today, doesn't that also remind us that if we can imagine a better future, we can take steps to achieving it? Because they were living in a time where, you know, I mean, I think it's pretty fair to say the divisions were even deeper. People were enslaved, you know, people were denied their civil rights by law, and yet they dared to think that things could be different.
I think that's perfect. I couldn't have said it better, Magna. I think that is the to be able to look at it as difficult as it is. And again, I think that's why it's so important to know our history, because what we see today, people endured so much worse than that and were able to achieve so much better.
Kaz, you've been at the museum for 35 years. What are you going to do next?
Yeah, well, I look forward to, and I think, as I've said to everybody who's asked me that, I think Crandall and Sarah's story isn't something that you can walk away from. So what I look forward to is there's still a lot of research work that needs to be done. And I think personally, I'd like to be able to do justice to the stories of the young African-American women who attended the academy. So that's what I'm hoping. I think I'd like to take a little bit, let the dust settle. But I think eventually Prudence and Sarah call us all back. So there's no walking away from that.
Well, Kaz Kozlowski served as curator of the Prudence Crandall Museum for 35 years. She's just recently retired. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you, and thank you for your work. Thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity, Magda. And again, it's an amazing story. I'm glad that I could share it with you.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.